It's called A Fourth Turning, Prophecy. Keep in mind, this book was written in 1997, and what you're about to hear, you'll shake your head and go, how did they know this? Back in a moment with our guest, Neil Howe, on Coast to Coast AM. How did the relationship between you, Neil, and William Strauss then come about?
Well, it was back in the mid-1980s. I moved down to Washington, D.C. area, where he lived, and we started talking about a book we do together on generational topics, particularly on why generations build things that last beyond their lifetimes, and why different generations seem to specialize in different kinds of activities. We were particularly at that time, as the 80s, we were impressed by how differently boomers were turning out than the generation that raised us, you know, the World War II winning GI. And we seemed so different. And as we grew older into adulthood, we weren't turning into them at all, right? Age was not making us more similar in our sort of life goals and our image of our role in history. And we actually looked back and we said, this is really interesting. You know, the GIs built all these institutions. They were junior citizens when they were kids. They won these wars and they built all this stuff, the suburbs, the interstate highways, the moon rockets and great society and all this stuff. And of course, as soon as the GI generation reached age 65, we invented a new word to describe old people, right? They started moving into Sun Cities and Leisure World, and we had a new word for them. We called them senior citizens, right?
Or Social Security.
Citizens. Huh?
Or Social Security.
Well, exactly. But you see, they were always, government always did good things for them. It protected them when they were kids with the child labor laws and the Volstead Act and all kinds of things to protect kids. And it got them their first jobs during the Depression. And they became the most uniformed generation per capita in American history during World War II. And then they came back and they had the GI Bill. And many of them went to college or vocational ed on the GI Bill. Two out of every $5 in mortgage payments during the 1950s was covered by the federal government in GI benefits. And as soon as they reached age 65 in 1965, we hugely expanded Social Security. We created Medicare and Medicaid. And as we know, the entire fiscal dividend of the Vietnam War, when that was over, all went into expanding Social Security and the Older Americans Act. So they've always had this reward, you know, achievement reward relationship with government that other generations have never had. They've always voted very heavily, collectively, for the future and for themselves. Other generations have always very much respected their role as institution builders. But boomers had a completely different relationship with their society. Boomers, you know, no one's going to call boomers senior citizens when we're old. So it's interesting.
That's a good thing.
According to AARP, the term senior citizen is already falling into disuse with the silent generation, which is entering, you know, old age. They're in their 70s now. We're going to have to invent a new word for the silent, you know, the Elvis Presley generation, I guess.
Yeah.
They're not the greatest generation. They're the nicest generation. I don't know, senior partners or something like that. Old boppers, maybe. I don't know.
The good people.
What? The nice people.
Yeah.
But boomers, you know, boomers are different. And boomers are taking over the culture. And part of the reason why so many GIs went to Leisure World and Sun City is they just couldn't stand, you know, the self-oriented rock and roll culture that was taking, you know, that was moving across America. And it's fascinating to me that GIs are associated with building institutions. Still today, they're the strength behind AARP, even in their 80s. We still bring on Henry Kissinger, George Shultz to advise us how to manage our, you know, government relations with other countries.
And we're still in the same mess, Neil.
Well, they're still in the same mess. But here's what's interesting about the GIs as a generation. Culturally, they've been invisible for the past 40 years. I can't think of a single novel or song, right, that we've identified with them. But boomers are just the opposite. Boomers are a weak generation politically, but they've always dominated the culture, and they dominate the culture wars, and they dominate argument in our society. And even in their 80s, boomers will still be screaming at each other on talk radio. I mean, you just know we're still going to be hearing those same 1,200 golden oldies from the 60s. And until the last boomer dies, and then every Xer is going to have a bonfire of celebration. But I mean, that, you see, and this is interesting, because back in the 1950s, when GIs were beginning to, you know, move into midlife and become leaders in America, C. Wright Mills called the leaders of America's institutions, he called them the power elite, right? The power elite. And in the 1990s, we invented a new word to describe boomers in midlife, the cultural elite, right? Doesn't that say it all? We've gone from GI to boom. We got from outer world builders to inner world complainers. And here we have this generation that's very good at pointing out, exploring values and articulating priorities for other generations, but not terribly good at cooperating and building themselves. You need a generation like boomers, but clearly you need other generations as well.
The fourth turning, the prophecy.
Well,
1997. How did you two come up with these? I mean, what signs did you see?
Well, let me just bring the story up. So just bring me on track here. So Bill and I wrote our first book, Generations, in 1993.
Right.
Okay. And that was a book that sort of retold all of American history from the 17th century by these generational stories. We took each generation and aged them, and then we started with the next generation and told their story. And through this process, not only did we identify these different archetypes, these different types of generations, but we found that they coincided with a certain rhythm in history itself, since the generations come in a certain order, so do events. In the fourth turning, which was a third book we wrote together, we turned that around. We started with a whole question of rhythms in history, cycles in history, war cycles, cycles of cultural revitalization, cycles of drug use, cycles of family life, cycles of violence, economic cycles. And we explained the major patterns in these cycles by generational change, by this process of generational change we identified. And that's when we came up with this rubric, these terms of the turnings, right? These social moods that accompany each of these generational eras. And on schedule, we expect that this new generation, millennials, will come of age into a young adulthood, and Xers will be entering midlife, and boomers will be entering old age. On schedule, each of these archetypes will be entering their next phase of life during this fourth turning. And we've seen these eras before in American history. We did not mean by this to be apocalyptic. It's not going to be an end of history or anything like that. America.
But it's scary. It is scary.
It's scary. These are the eras we're most likely to have total wars in. I mean, historically, there's much that's sobering about the prospect of a fourth turning, but it shouldn't be paralyzing, is what I mean to say. Historically, we've actually solved huge problems in a fourth turning, right? We solved the problem of slavery. We solved the problem of creating a global economy and overcoming fascism and various forms of totalitarianism. We've done some amazing things. In previous fourth turnings, we've refashioned the relationship between, you know, man and technology, between government and the economy. We've done some amazing things we probably couldn't do without an era of urgency and crisis. But it is a time of enormous public risk. It's a time when public history will begin moving fast again, in ways that we're not used to. In the 1980s and 90s. We're used to history moving very incrementally, slowly. It almost doesn't matter to most people. You ask most Gen Xers who their entire adult life has been in the 80s and 90s, they think of history as public history, political history, is somehow just practically irrelevant, right? The only thing that happens is government is less effective or has less influence on anything. I mean, that's basically the only thing they've ever seen. They do not remember, as boomers remember more, and certainly the silent GI generations remember, times when history can move suddenly, lurch in gigantic directions in ways that wake everyone up and make everyone care again about the big picture.
You were talking about your prophecy around the year 2005, but that give or take a few years, right?
We basically, this could occur, you know, given the various kinds of you know, generational guidelines, this could occur any time between sort of early in that decade through 2005, 2010, even early into the next decade. Any of these times would be roughly coincident with these new generational transitions.
What?
So 2008 is a fine date.
Absolutely. What trends were you seeing back in 97 when you were beginning to put this book together?
Well, you see, that's the thing. We didn't have to see the crisis then. And that's part of our method. At that time,
brilliant.
There was no crisis on the horizon. So what we foresaw was that as each of these generations moves into this next phase of life, begins to age, as the silent generation gets kicked out so they can no longer compromise or moderate, as boomers get to be more fully in power with all of their, you know, zealotry, right? And as Xers who have so little attachment to political loyalties or commitments of any time, they're willing to do, you know, whatever it takes, go in any direction very quickly. And then you have this millennial generation. We predicted that given what has happened earlier in American history, that the mood would darken and that accidents of history would be more likely to ignite a very sudden reaction by the public sector. And also, given the fact that in the third turning, no one is looking out for our collective direction, liabilities would mount, debts would mount, the lack of oversight of the entire system would lead to these incredible imbalances. I mean, one of the things we find out today, right, with the 777-point decline in the Dow Jones, everyone's finally waking up to this shadow banking system. SIVs, CDOs, money market funds, monolines, hedge funds. We have this entire system of institutions which basically,
mirrors.
They lend long and they borrow short, just like banks, and they're an unregulated banking system. We just wake up to find, my God, no one has any control of this. But this is typical of how, in a fourth turning, we wake up from the mood of loss of control, this mood of rampant individualism.
Now, is it possible, though, that somewhere along the line, and we're going to get into these specifics here of the prophecies, can we screw this up? Can we ruin the outcome?
Yes, we certainly can. If every generation fills its role very badly, particularly the leadership generation. I mean, consider, George, consider the Civil War. If we had had nuclear weapons, would we have used them? I think that question answers itself.
That is a good question.
I think that question answers itself. You bet we would have used them. If you read Abraham Lincoln's second, inauguration speech, where he talks of the rivers of blood that may have to flow before God's judgment is realized at the end of this mighty contest, shaking the new world. And you look at the loss of life that Grant was willing to incur in reaching the final solution. You wonder, don't you?
Yeah, you do.
I think it matters a great deal how it is led and the wisdom of the decisions made along the way. One thing we can say about every fourth turning is that although the events that touch off, and this has been true of every fourth turning historically, although the events which touch off a fourth turning are predictable ahead of time, I mean, there have been people who've pointed out the problems with our financial system. I mean, we can't say they haven't. There are people who've pointed out, the problem with loose nukes around the world in North Korea and Iran. We've known about that. That's an issue. Before the market crash of 1929, people were pointing out the weaknesses of our financial system. People were pointing out the problems of slavery, and that was well known to be a real instability in our republic in the 1850s. So what touched off these crises was foreseen. But what absolutely no one could foresee was how much the country would be transformed by the time the crisis was over. I mean, people could have foreseen a tax riot in Boston. You know, in the 1860s, no one could have foreseen the establishment of this, you know, national republic by the late 1780s. No one could have imagined the United States at the end of the Civil War suddenly becoming this incredibly more powerful republic with a huge diminution in states' rights. And certainly no one could have foreseen in 1925 the America of 1945, just 20 years later, right, suddenly a world power, master of nuclear power, with a government with enormously increased in size and controlling the economy and the center of
and trusted
commerce.
And what? Trusted and trusted, Neil,
and trusted, but it completely transformed. All I'm saying is, in each of these cases, we could imagine before the crisis what touches it off, but we could never imagine how rapidly history would move and how much our country could be transformed by the end.
And the outcome, of course, I don't like, based on what I read, because when I read most of these five major issues from the prophecy, I think all of them, some are happening, but all of them are very possible to happen. And it's just amazing the outcome of this, something we've theorized for years, and you had it 10 years ago.
Well, I'll tell you what's interesting about history, when you read history and you read what happens. When these crises come and when they're touched off by certain events, everyone is shocked initially. But only a couple of years have to go by when everyone, in retrospect, puts it together in a story as though it was inevitable. I think that's what's really interesting. By the late 1930s, everyone had a storyline about how somehow the Depression was inevitable. And, well, no one felt it was inevitable at the time. You know, and even in 1930, a year later, people are saying, well, this is just a short, you know, downturn. We'll all spring back. You know, Hoover will be okay. And it's only later on do we draw this storyline of inevitability. It's kind of like a tree grows around a wound and sort of covers it up and explains it away. And I think we do that when we think about even our own personal lives. When we go through a trauma, we invent a story to make it all make sense later on. But at the time, it doesn't make sense. It surprises us. And at some subliminal level, we may be aware of the danger, but it's only in retrospect do we think it all makes sense.
That's a good point. Neil, the book's still out there now?
Absolutely. I mean, you can buy it on Amazon. You can buy it on our website. It's all of our books remain in print.
And your website?
Our website is, we have two websites, actually. One is our business site, which is lifecourse.com, one word. And our other site, which is a very long-running discussion forum for all issues related to the fourth turning, which is appropriately www.fourthturning.com.
Simple enough. When we come back, let's go through all these prophecies now and talk about the possibilities. Some of them we're into now. Some of them we're beginning to go into. Over what period of time do you see the prophecies fulfilled?
Well, I see these kinds of events really building to a climax over the next 20 years. I see the climax probably of this fourth turning. It will certainly be accelerating in the next decade, and it will climax sometime probably late in the 2020s. And by that time, you know, we boomers will be completely into old age. Our Social Security will probably be cut. Xers will be the, you know, why ask why midlifers, and millennials, they'll be the new middle class in all of their starter homes.
All right. Well, you stay with us. Neil Howe, our special guest, the book, The Fourth Turning. We'll be back with Neil in just a moment. We're going to go through these five major points of prophecy that he pointed out for us. Back in a moment. Let's go through these five major items of the fourth turning prophecy, if we can, Neil. The first, you have the financial crisis. Well, here we are. Tell us about this.
Well, these were just little hypothetical scenarios. We actually had a fourth turning prophecy chapter near the end of our book, and we had a couple little scenarios. One of this was a fiscal crisis. The state lays claim to federal tax money, and The president declares this an act of secession. The governor doesn't back down. Federal marshals attempt to enforce the court order. Tax rebellions spring up in other states. You know, pretty soon, treasury bill auctions are suspended. The special forces are alerted. You can see where this is going. Ultimately, demands are issued for a new constitutional convention. An interesting scenario. This is what we might call the ultimate tax revolt scenario, right? The anti-federalists suddenly rise up again. And we can see, too, that when we have a third turning, when you have huge regional differences and states which suddenly say, why is all our revenue going for, you know, to be flowing into a Congress which has an approval rating of what, 10% now?
Yeah.
Why? We don't agree with where most of it's being spent, so why should we spend it? And you can imagine a boomer governor, a boomer legislator saying, hell no, we won't let it go, right? And putting their foot down and becoming confrontational. Okay. Let's see, what's another one here? What's our second one?
Number two, a global terrorist group blowing up an aircraft and announces it's got portable, which we've always feared, nuclear weapons.
The U.S. and its allies launch a preemptive strike. The terrorists threaten to retaliate against an American city. Congress declares war and authorizes unlimited house-to-house searches. Opponents charge that the president concocted the emergency for political purposes. A nationwide strike is declared. Foreign capital flees the U.S. This is very interesting. Of course, we wrote this 4 years before 9/11, right?
That's right. That's right.
But it's very interesting to think of, Senator Ashcroft, who became our attorney general, actually, of course, cracking down on all kinds of cutting through many of our traditional safeguards, or at least cutting corners. In an attempt to preempt what these terrorist cells may be doing in this country. And I have always thought it's interesting, but I find this very curious about the ACLU, you know, which is very hard, you know, which is always defending, right, every right that we have.
Everything. Yeah.
It always strikes me that if the ACLU had any intelligence, they would be in favor of strict enforcement against, you know, a very rigorous pursuit of terrorist cells, because the ACLU should foresee that if any large bomb goes off, certainly if a nuke goes off, frankly, anywhere in the world, much less in the United States, the civil liberties would be just gone in this country overnight. In other words, from the ACLU's own position,
the Constitution could be gone overnight.
I mean, you and I know what would happen. And even not necessarily a nuclear bomb, but any massive act of terrorism after 9/11, I think would people just wouldn't listen to them anymore. We would have house-to-house searches. And fear overrides all of this stuff. So it would always seem to me, if I were the head of the ACLU, I would be thanking Ashcroft that nothing happened, right? So that we can still defend these rights and liberties that we've been accustomed to. Anyway.
Well, but it's frightening, because what are our concerns now? Possibility of nukes.
Absolutely.
Possibility of suitcase nukes.
Absolutely, and I think that we now have the CIA chief just today declaring on TV that the Al-Qaeda in Waziristan is stronger than ever. And that all of the recent, over the last two or three years, every single terrorist plot that they have actually uncovered has been hatched in the northwest province of Pakistan, and this is alive and going again. They're getting huge immigration from all over the region of young men coming to join their cause. I think we obviously haven't heard the last of that.
No.
Okay.
Not at all. But you also see a nationwide strike is declared.
Well, that's it.
Tied into this?
I don't know. You can judge the plausibility of that. But I certainly can see. Here's what's interesting about what we proposed. Opponents charge that the president concocted the emergency for political purposes. This is fascinating. Every fourth turning has had these charges. You remember that FDR was charged with not doing anything about Pearl Harbor because he wanted it to happen. FDR knew, even in 1939, was personally convinced that America would get involved in World War II. He knew it was going to happen. He strongly suspected that sooner or later America would have to engage the struggle. He strongly sympathized with Churchill after the war broke out in Europe, but he knew that the American public wasn't with him. Now, it's interesting to calculate this from the point of view of a president. What if you truly are convinced that sooner or later you're going to get in the crisis, and the sooner you get in, the better off we'll be? It may actually, in some level, make you actually invite something, right?
Yep,
to turn public opinion in your direction. Winston Churchill leapt up for joy when he heard the news of Pearl Harbor. I mean, he didn't even pretend to be sad. He knew what this meant, that the Allies now would prevail. Now, this has happened every time. The same thing has happened, you know, with the Civil War. And people thought that in the Civil War, the leaders on both sides deliberately tried to provoke a crisis to legitimize their own positions. I think it's a very interesting calculation when you consider George W. Bush, his administration. They would have been, you know, from a purely political point of view, well served by another terrorist attack. I may sound cynical for saying that, but frankly, if one had happened, everyone would have said, my God, you know, the danger is still out there. Well, another didn't happen. I don't think he gets much credit for it. I think everyone basically says, well, he obviously overdid it, right? We didn't need to do all that stuff, and a lot of his policies have been a mistake. Anyway, my point is that any leader going into a fourth turning is going to have to make very interesting calculations on to what extent he actually wants to solve the crisis too early, or he wants the crisis to actually wake up the public in order to really solve it. I think it's an interesting calculus that a leader has to make.
And a dangerous one if he misjudges.
Terribly dangerous. Absolutely dangerous. Catastrophically dangerous. What's our next example here?
Oh, well, I'm just going to give us one line of the paragraph because it says it all. Wall Street panics.
Ah, yes.
And you were talking primarily about the federal budget reaches a stalemate and the president calls for emergency powers. This is very like, though, what's going on right now.
Well,
there is a stalemate in Congress over the bailout.
There is a stalemate, and both parties are absolutely, cannot get beyond blaming each other for causing it. You know, absolutely futile activity. Obviously, both parties are heavily implicated in this. The Republicans, because they've been in power while this entire, you know, shadow banking system, the shadow financial system, has basically grown up with you know, no regulation. But the Democrats as well, because the Democrats were pushing the Community Reinvestment Act and pushing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to invest in all this low-income housing. You know, interestingly, when Barack Obama got his job as a community organizer in South Chicago, one of his first jobs was to help file a lawsuit against Citibank for not lending enough to homeowners in South Chicago. And the Democrats, if anything, have gotten more lobbying money from Fannie Mae than the Republicans. But my point is, both parties are up to their neck in complicity. But rather than, and this isn't this typical of boomers, right? Rather than say, let's just forget this, let's just roll up our hands, we got a problem here to solve. This just doesn't have to do with blaming anyway. There's just nonstop blame. You know, we got the conservatives and these gerrymandered districts in the House. They think this is all a socialist plot. You've got Nancy Pelosi, who basically went on a 5-minute tirade. I think we heard that, about how this was all the fault of the Bush administration. It's a frightening prospect we're looking at Congress right now.
You foresee a president stopping Social Security checks?
Well, that would only be, of course, if there were a complete, you know,
budget.
A complete budget crisis. Social Security remains an appropriation. It is not, you know, Congress can cut Social Security without violating the due process clause. It's not like invalidating, you know, treasury bonds. That would be actually, that would violate the takings clause of the Constitution. Congress has the right to to cut Social Security anytime they want. And there's nothing in the Constitution that says they can't do that. And if there's no appropriations, they will have to, you know, prorate and or something and spend, you know, reduce the amount of every check. This would be obviously only happen in the most extreme circumstance. I'll tell you one thing, though, that this shows the ostrich-like vision of America's leaders. I think we all watched that debate, you know, the other night,
yeah.
Obama and McCain.
Friday night, yeah.
And nothing should be sadder than what these two people had to say about the economy. McCain spent, I don't know how long, talking about earmarks and some, I don't know, what was it, a DNA experiment on moose or what was, do you remember that thing?
Yeah.
That federal project? I mean, he's talking about this tiny sliver of the budget. 60% of the federal budget is Social Security, Medicare, civil service pensions, interest on the debt and other entitlements. That's it. Military is another 20%. All the rest of the domestic federal government is the remaining 20%. It's the entire civil service, the health service, the Oceanographic Institute, our hurricane centers, our national, you know, everything else. And earmarks is a tiny fraction of that. That's not where the money is. And I find it amazing that these two candidates will talk about these little outrages, right? None of them will talk about where the money is. And that's because the mentality is among leaders, you can't say anything bad to an entitled group in America, right?
Exactly.
We all have these entitlements. You cannot mention that. Social Security is the third rail. Medicare is the third rail. You know, everything's got a group behind it. Let's go after earmarks.
The other prophecy, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announcing a spread of a new communicable virus. It reaches densely populated areas. Some die.
Yeah, and what's interesting in all of these, it's not just the event that causes the fourth turning. It's the reaction to the event, right? Congress enacts mandatory quarantine measures. President orders National Guard to throw cordons around unsafe neighborhoods. Mayors resist. Urban gangs battle suburban militias. And a calls to declare martial law. It's the anarchic reaction. In a third-turning world, of course, no one's going to follow what the president says. No one's going to follow Congress. We're all going to assume that they're crazy. So there's no trust in the institutions. We're all going to resist to try to save ourselves. And, of course, this pushes us in to a new political and social mood that's unrelated to the initial event that pushed us there. Of course, we wrote this before SARS and before the, you know, the anthrax mailings and some of this other stuff. But
and the avian flu, we didn't even know about it.
Yeah, we didn't know about that yet. This final one we have here.
And let me read this one in
that
full.
It's been a little bit in the news, yeah.
This is incredible. Here it is. Growing anarchy throughout the former Soviet republics prompts Russia to conduct training exercises around its border. Lithuania erupts in civil war. Negotiations break down. U.S. diplomats are captured, publicly taunted. The president airlifts troops to rescue them and orders ships into the Black Sea. Iran declares its alliance with Russia. Gold and oil prices soar. Congress debates restoring the draft. The only thing that hasn't happened yet is Congress hasn't debated restoring the draft. And it's not Lithuania, but it could be Georgia or any other place. But it's all happening.
Yeah, this is if you just substitute the name of Georgia and just, you know, change a couple of the details. This is Russia acting as the sort of the rebirth of the old Tsarist Empire, reasserting its regional influence. It wants control over energy, and it wants to cow into submission the other former states, particularly the Ukraine, into acknowledging its local dominance. And this is deliberately designed for that. Poland, you know, after objecting to having our missiles lodged there, I don't know if you noticed, it wasn't covered much in the news, but immediately after the invasion of Georgia, Poland said, okay, bring these missiles right now. Argument over.
Yeah.
Install them here immediately, please.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, even Eastern Europe, even the countries that many of whom are part of NATO, is a bit frightened by this new turn of events. This probably, this particular scenario here, is very close to something we could easily imagine.
And it could be very, it could very well be the most dangerous, Neil.
Well, it could. We all know that, you know, the Russia remains a loaded nuclear power. It also remains a very dangerous country for another reason. There is the spirit of revanchism in the Soviet Union. They are a great power which has been humiliated. Remember the Weimar Republic after World War One, Germany? They were a great power that had been humiliated. At least that was, of course, the impression in Germany. They had been humiliated and stabbed in the back. It's very dangerous, I think, particularly looking at countries, to be particularly suspicious of countries which have an historic tradition of greatness from which it is perceived they have declined. This has often been pointed out even of Iran, you know, which had the great Achaemenid Empire. You know, they used to have Persia used to do this mighty empire, and now what is it? You know, so there's always the sense in the people that the greatness from which we have fallen, we are due more than that, right? History owes us more. And I think you certainly find that sense in Russia. The Pew study of international attitudes toward democracy shows that Russia is at the very bottom, meaning that in Russia, of all countries of the world, the public is most contemptuous of democratic values. They think a strong ruler is what they need now, and of course, that's what they've got.
And they're running with it, and they're not going to stop.
No.
And these alliances, though, that's the other thing. Venezuela, Iran, they're picking up all these nations that can't stand us.
Well, they are. I thought that was actually John McCain's best line in the debate. I stared into Putin's eyes, and I saw KGB. Do you remember that?
Yep, that absolutely. Was nice. Well, and he was right about that.
Yeah, he was.
Putin has never changed. When he came to power, it was probably the worst thing that could have happened. It's unfortunate that Gorbachev wasn't still around. I see where he's trying to form another party.
Oh, it's hopeless. The frightening thing about Putin is not Putin. The frightening thing about Putin is his popularity. To me, that's what's
true.
He is very popular in Russia, particularly young Russians. They have this new organization called NASHI, you know, ours, you know, our movement. And it's practically a quasi-fascist group of these young people who all dress in uniforms and walk through the cities. And they're all into raising the fertility rate. That, of course, is a big problem in Russia. It's very low fertility, population decline. And here's a country that not only do they face humiliation geopolitically, but their very future is being threatened by rapid depopulation. It's just a risky scenario on many fronts.
Neil, we've got another final hour to go. We're going to take phone calls. You ready for them?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, that's what we shall do when we come right back. We'll take phone calls with our special guest tonight, Neil Howe. A couple of his books out there, Generation and then The Fourth Turning. So we'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Neil Howe, our special guest. Your phone calls are next.